Okay. All right, we're rolling. All right. Andy and Veronica, welcome to Bitcoin Fixes This. Glad to have you guys on. And we're going to talk about healthcare today. So this should be, very easy and uncomplicated, right? why don't you guys tell my audience a little bit about your background so they get a little familiarity with
sure.
you guys.
Sure. Yeah, so my name is Veronica Max. I am a family nurse practitioner and founder of Ultra Personal Healthcare. So we're a concierge practice that provides primary care, functional medicine, health optimization via membership model. So it's a direct relationship with your provider. Very high level of customer experience, which is something that there is no, the bar is very low in healthcare. And so that's what I do for a living. But I have four children, live outside of Austin, Texas, about 45 minutes outside of the city, and have a homestead. So we produce about 90% of our own protein at this point.
Oh, nice.
So very much about sovereign, sovereign food, sovereign health, and of course, sovereign sound money.
Awesome.
And you had all your kids at home, right?
I did have all my kids at home. Yeah.
Okay.
There you go.
That's something. Wow.
She's legit.
Yeah.
My name's Andy Schoonover, as you said. CEO of Crowd Health. And in essence, what we're trying to do is create a decentralized platform that allows people to pay for their healthcare expenses without the need for health insurance.
So. Yeah, and I've had you on the show, and we've definitely talked about it. What I want to talk about...
You're an inspiration, partly, for me starting the company, or at least the current directory of the company.
Well, I'm very happy to be a customer at this point and trying it out and doing things this way, because like for a long time, it was this giant black hole of money where I have no idea where it's going, but somebody's benefiting, and it ain't me. So... Yeah. But we'll talk about that in a little bit. What I want to talk about today is basically how to navigate the system, because both of you guys are come from different backgrounds, but you know how the system works, mostly because you guys have been in it for quite a while and have experience in it. And in your case, Andy, let's talk about, let's start with the incentives of the current system. And we know that health insurance companies have a significant amount of say to the level of care that most people get. Can you talk to us a little bit about the economic incentives at play here and what we should be aware of as consumers of the healthcare system?
Yeah.
I mean, well, first off, insurance companies, I think Andy, the other night when we were chatting, you provided a great stat about denials, right? A lot of people think that when they have health insurance, they're covered. What was the stat?
Yeah, there's 48 million claims in 2021. That's the last year of data that we have for Obamacare plans were denied. So, and that was about 17% of claims. So you have about a 1 in 6 chance if you submit a claim with Obamacare plans that you're going to get denied.
Wow.
So, it's one where I've told the story on your thing before. Is the reason I joined Crowd Health is because I had an $8,000 bill for my daughter's ear tubes because she had a perforated eardrum that got denied by an Obamacare plan. You know, and it's like most people can't pay $8,000.
Out of pocket.
Like that's just probably 95% of the U.S. population just doesn't have that amount of money. And so to have that bill denied is a significant financial consequence.
I followed up after, after that talk and was looking into the numbers of that. And some companies, the rates, of course, it's kind of hush hush. It's hard to find these numbers. I guess you could find the ones about Obamacare because it's government. But these rates anywhere from a 2% rejection rate all the way up to a 50% denial of claims. So I think it's really important for people to understand that their health insurance is not as bulletproof as they think it is.
Yeah. And, the other thing, too, with some of these plans is the legislators about 10 years ago thought it was a really good idea to maximize the amount of profit that these health insurance plans can make. And so, outside looking in without any kind of understanding of economics, it makes emotional sense. Like, mm-hmm. we don't want health insurance plans scamming us or denying mm-hmm. a bunch of claims so they make a bunch of money. So what mm-hmm. they did is they maxed the profit at mm-hmm. 15% of claims. Mm-hmm. And so if you do the math on this, let's just use easy math. If my premiums mm-hmm. are $1,000 a month, the max the insurance plans can make is $150 a month. Mm-hmm. Well, how do they increase their profit by 10% every year? These are for-profit companies. Mm-hmm. Well, your insurance profit, your premium has to go up by 10%. Mm. So to make $165, they have to have your premium go from $1,000 to $1,100. Mm. So in essence, what happens here is that the insurance companies have an incentive for long-term costs to go up, right? Because then they can make more money. So the sicker you are, the more money they make. And, you know, this is a principal agent problem where mm-hmm. they are supposed to be our agent trying to find really good prices for us. But in essence, what they are is they're incentivized to see all those prices go up. Mm. So you have the insurance companies who are the buyers of healthcare and hospital systems who are the primary sellers of healthcare, mm. both wanting the price to go up. Guess what? The price is going up, right? Like that's the perverse incentives of our current system that is leading to this, you know. I talked to a guy the other day, and his corporate insurance was going up 22% this year.
Oh, my goodness.
And that's just nearly impossible for them to recover. Mm. So it's, you know, inflation times three over the last 20 years.
Mm. Wow. So, I mean, I was going to ask about the claim denials, but it sounds like if the 15% is what they can make, they probably pretty much always make 15% because it's capped.
I would assume.
Well, they manage. So, you know, uh-huh. long term, they mm-hmm. want the claims to go up, mm-hmm. right? Because they make more money over the long term. Over the short term, mm-hmm. they actually want, you know, to manage around that 15%. Mm-hmm. So if they're running a little higher than 15%, then there's actually lawsuits right now mm-hmm. that are showing many of the large companies just have an algorithm mm-hmm. where they blanket deny claims across the board. And the problem with that is that very few people come back and fight that. Mm-hmm. So in Obamacare, I think it was like 1-2% mm-hmm. that will actually fight it. So they're like, okay, we'll just deny it. Mm-hmm. Most won't fight it. Mm-hmm. And so we can manage around that perfect, you know, efficiency mm-hmm. around that 15%. Mm-hmm. And so in the short term, they actually have an incentive to deny claims. In the long term, they have an incentive to see claims go up. So you're screwed in the long term and the short term. Like mm-hmm. that's how messed up the system is.
All right. So what happens once a claim gets denied? Say I got a procedure from you, Veronica, and you know, it was $1,000. And the insurance company denies it. What happens economically between me and you?
I mean, the procedure, usually mm-hmm. this is called prior authorization. So mm-hmm. the doctor's office would, before they even do the procedure, because they want to mm-hmm. make sure that they're going to get paid, right? They're going to mm-hmm. Contact the insurance company and make mm-hmm. sure, do a prior auth. Mm-hmm. And if that is denied, mm-hmm. then there is an appeals process. Mm-hmm. But as Andy mentioned, you know, that people often don't want to go to the hassle of doing that. Mm-hmm. As a physician or a nurse practitioner, you mm-hmm. know, they can get additional information from the provider to try to, you know, mm-hmm. advocate for the patient on, you know, on their behalf if we think that's important. However, it's also important to understand that physicians, mm-hmm. nurse practitioners, PAs in the traditional model that's accepting insurance, they don't have a lot of time to do that.
Right. Or staff to do it.
Yeah. Right. So even if they want to, you know, they really care about their patient and they want to help them, they've got limited resources and time that they can spend on the phone with the insurance company. Mm-hmm. And as you guys know very well, I don't know if you've called an insurance mm-hmm. company mm-hmm. Recently, but it's almost like a game, right? Mm-hmm. You know, they'll transfer you around to a million different people. Your call gets dropped, mm-hmm. you know, then you're transferred to someone that you can't even understand what they're saying because uh-huh. it's an overseas call center. Uh-huh. I mean, I have to imagine this is happening on purpose. Mm.
Well, it sounds like there's a bureaucracy that sort of makes it a little bit more difficult.
So most people just throw their hands up and say, whether it's the provider mm-hmm. or the patient, I don't want to forget it. I'm going to pay out of pocket.
Okay. Well, so for those are sort of like predetermined procedures, but obviously for anything emergency related where you have to,
like a hospital visit or something.
Yeah. If those get denied, then what happens?
I can tell you on mine, you know, my $8,000 tubes in my daughter's ear, where an ear, nose, and throat doc's like, she's got a hole in her eardrum. Mm-hmm. Like, this has to get fixed. Mm-hmm. They denied it. Mm-hmm. And so we went through three rounds of an appeal process, which was my ear, nose, and throat doc debating with, I think, an ophthalmologist, funny enough, internally at the health plan, saying this, it should be done. And the ophthalmologist saying this shouldn't be done. So an ophthalmologist is somebody who takes care of your eyes. Like, it has nothing to do with your ears.
Right.
So, and they're saying no, this person is saying yes. And even at the end of the day, they can basically say, sorry, you know, we're not paying for it. So there's a three-step appeal process at most health plans. Some have two, some have three. But you have to walk through that appeals process, which means you have to call your doctor and say, please, can you help me with this appeals process? And then the doctor's kind of like, okay, like, you know, like, all I want to do is get paid. And ultimately, the bill lands on me as a responsibility. You walk into a doctor's office or a hospital and you sign a form that says, if the insurance denies the claim, I am responsible. So in essence, I have to figure it out after that. The insurance company is kind of like, sorry, it's not my deal anymore. I'm not paying for it. So again, it's a totally, you know, screwed up system that I you know, it's based upon a business to business type of relationship. You know, healthcare has kind of been built over the last 50 years on hospitals and insurance plans working together. So CPT codes and all these kinds of crazy things, like, you wouldn't see that on an Apple iPhone, right? Like, you know, it's not a direct to consumer. And so they just are like, consumer, you're not even really a part of this, even though it's your health. Let us take care of it. And when we can't figure it out, well, now it is your problem and you have to figure it out. And they leave people with these bills that, you know, the mission behind Crowd Health is like 200,000 families last year, somewhere between 200 and 250,000 families last year went bankrupt due to medical bills, even though they had health insurance. Like, so this is the whole point of health insurance is, you know, if something big happens,
protect you.
It doesn't put you into financial distress. Yet we have somewhere between 200 and 250,000 families going bankrupt every year, even though they have health insurance.
So
that's the craziness of this.
They make you pay for it if it doesn't.
If they deny it, I have to pay for it.
Right. So that brings up the question, like, how do you navigate these things so these things don't happen to you? Because I think, practically speaking, this is sort of like the nightmare scenario that everyone is thinking of, is kind of like that bankruptcy scenario where something bad happens to you and then for whatever reason you get screwed over by the system and next thing you know you have no money, right? They've sort of extracted everything from you. How do you prevent that? Like, other than not getting into accidents or whatever, like, what do you do? What's something that, I guess, as like just normal people, like, what can you do to not get screwed over by the system? What are some possibilities?
I mean, I think it starts with education. You know, educating yourself first off. I mean, most people, I don't know how many people you've talked to before that have health insurance don't understand their own health insurance, right? They might know their premium, but a lot of people don't know what their deductible is. They might not even know what that means, right?
Copay, co-insurance, max out of pocket,
network,
like,
like, if you have to go to the hospital and have a surgery, are you covered 100%? Is it 80%? Is it 20%? You know, a lot of people don't know that. They just assume that they're covered. So first it would be, I think, educating yourself on what is the product you have and what does it cover? And then also understanding what the other options are out there. You know, options like Crowd Health. And or even just the fact that, you know, most people are unaware that when you go into a doctor's office, if you just say, I'm going to pay self-pay, you're usually offered about a 50% discount. Or if you get a hospital bill, right, you end up in the ER and it was out of network, so your insurance isn't going to cover it, or which happens all the time, too. There's been some news coverage of that over the last few years. You can actually go and negotiate with the accounting department and, you know, and you'd be able to speak to that more than I could about what type of savings you can get.
Yeah, I think I'm even more skeptical. So my answer would be like, you can't. You can't navigate it. And if you're in the insurance system, you can't navigate it. It's nearly impossible. So, I mean, you can go through the 125-page member guide that most of these plans have. And if you read it, you still come across, you know, it's you know, like reading hieroglyphics. Like, you just, it's nearly impossible to understand. Even if you did understand it, so let's, you know, make that assumption for a minute. You know, if you go to the hospital, you, let's just say you are unconscious and you're in the hospital, you will have an assortment, you know, a dozen different doctors or providers treating you within that hospital. Some may be in network, some may be out of network. You may be going to an in-network hospital, but your anesthesiologist is out of network, or your labs are out of network, or your emergency room doc is out of network. Like, you, it's nearly impossible within that scenario to navigate. You know, so,
or to plan ahead of time.
It's always going to be after the fact. It's going to be a surprise.
The whole point of insurance is for, like, for the big stuff, right? And when you get into the big stuff, it's nearly impossible to navigate the big stuff within insurance to make sure that at the end of the day, the insurance plan is going to do it. I mean, my my daughter's ear tubes, like, the doctor called the insurance company beforehand and said, is this covered? Yes, it's covered. We went to the hospital that is in network and got these this procedure. We still got a bill later that said, oh, sorry, it's not covered. Wait, hold on a second. Like, you just said it was covered, you know? And so we tried to navigate that, and you still, at the end of the day, the insurance plans have you kind of by the whatever, and, you know, they can do whatever they want. And they have such pull within a lot of the regulatory, you know, agencies that you can call, you know, the DOI, Department of Insurance, or whatever, and they're kind of like, meh, you know? And so they really, that really is the truth of this, is that they have so much pull. There's not more lobbying done by any other industry than pharma, hospitals, and health insurance. So money is, in essence, driving, you know, the majority of this. So I'm very skeptical, maybe, you know.
I mean, I'm on board, and I agree with you. There's a reason. I don't have to put words in your mouth. I don't have traditional health insurance either. But no, they you know, you're at their mercy at the end of the day. I mean, I'll give you an example. You know, I have a lot of patients that have insurance, you know, traditional insurance for, you know, their catastrophic care within my practice. But we tell people, you know, for instance, when we do labs, hey, you can certainly use your insurance, but most likely it's probably going to be a lot cheaper just to do self-pay through us, because we have, you know, great account pricing. But I've seen bills, you know, labs that cost maybe $140 for us, $1,800 when their insurance denies it because it's not medically necessary, right? Because I'm screening for things, you know, to catch disease really early or for health optimization, not, you know, for disease management.
I got I was in the ER, unfortunately, 2 weeks ago. And metabolic health panel, which they did, I got double billed for it first, which is, you know, I'm still working through that. But the local lab charged me, I think it was $6 or $7. The hospital charged me for the exact same panel, $250. I was telling her this the other day, where, you know, you have this IV, you know, which is a bag of salt water basically hanging with a little pump in the middle that's, you know, you can buy for $1,500 online. And they charged me for that $3 bag of saline, $5,400.
Wow.
For a $3 bag of saline. I was going to ask you to bring one for me.
Yeah, so
I
know.
I mean, that's the craziness of this system. So when you ask, how do you navigate that? I mean, you're literally on a bed, you have no power, and they just do it, right? And you have, you only find out about it later. You know, and you can't sit there being like, how much is this? How much is this? How much is this?
Because there's zero transparency. They wouldn't even, the people, they wouldn't even be able to answer that question.
They would have when no
you,
idea.
Yeah.
Well, the people giving you the care have no idea.
They have no idea.
Oh, all right. Well, so let's talk about the pricing a little bit, because that's confusing to me. You just said that a panel that should have cost $140, somehow they're charging $1,800 to the insurance. What's going on?
So say insurance doesn't cover it, the lab's going to bill the patient $1,800. I mean, I've seen these bills, $1,800 for labs that cost $140.
Well, who makes it? Is it some bean counter in the back that says, okay, you know what? Let's just multiply by 15 or whatever. Like, what? How do they figure out that it's $1,800 when they're charging you $140? Like, how do they determine this price?
Andy, do you have an answer for that?
Yeah, I mean,
it has to do with insurance companies and what they bill them.
You know, so what happens is, right, let's talk about Austin for a minute. We're all in Austin. You have these four or five large insurance plans who provide health insurance to pretty much everybody. They're called the BUCA plans, Blue Cross, United, Cigna, and Aetna. You can add Humana in there if you want to. But they come in and they say, okay, St. David's and Ascension, those are the two big systems here. I want to negotiate with you. And St. David's and Ascension says, no, Mm-hmm. You know, we're not negotiating the pricing. And mm-hmm. so in essence, what you have is these duopolies fighting against an oligopoly. Mm-hmm. Then the oligopoly is okay with the prices going up. Mm-hmm. And so these prices just get inflated. Mm-hmm. And then the people who are actually getting the treatment have no desire to get in between that, mm-hmm. you know, so there's no market forces who are driving these prices down. Mm-hmm. And we don't care what the prices is. So we just mm-hmm. consume, mm-hmm. you consume. And then the other part of that is you actually have to bill for this stuff, mm-hmm. right? And so it's very difficult to bill for insurance plans because it's back and forth. Mm-hmm. Doctors spend about 30 or 40% of their time dealing with health insurance companies. So the bureaucracy mm-hmm. increases all of that price. Whereas if I come to you or, mm-hmm. you know, a lab and say, I'm just going to pay with a credit card, mm-hmm. they will give you massive discounts because I don't have to bill insurance. I get the cash right away. Mm. You know, insurance companies don't pay for 3 or 4 months typically. Yeah. Mm. And so, you know, all of that benefit, the doctors or the lab or whoever will say, I'll take cash, mm. right? And so they will give you a massively better price mm. by just paying in cash.
Well, so a lot of it is just to avoid the price premium is a result of the bureaucracy. Correct. Essentially.
Yep. Yeah. So about most doctor's offices, uh-huh. 40 to 50% of their overhead mm-hmm. is going towards dealing with insurance. The personnel, uh-huh. the software. I mean, that's
the
insane.
Letters back and forth.
Yeah.
Well, $4.3 trillion spent in healthcare mm-hmm. in the United States. 8% mm-hmm. of it goes to doctors. Mm. So wow. 8%.
Wow.
I mean, you know, and so there's NPs and nurses and things like that, which are all a part of that too, but mm-hmm. like 8% of actually is used for care. Mm. So where's the other 92% going? Mm. It's bureaucracy and things mm-hmm. like that mm-hmm. can get ripped out of the system mm. if you just pay, you know, direct, you know, with a credit card or Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. You know, that's where we think there's a huge opportunity in the US healthcare system.
Mm. Well, so what percentage of your patients like go to collections or something? What percentage of your bills, like if you're a typical doctor's office, like end up going there? Because like I can't imagine people can pay $1,800.
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know that because I'm uh-huh. you know, I have a uh-huh. different, I'm operating in a different system uh-huh. because of all of this. Uh-huh. But I know it. I mean, it does happen quite uh-huh. quite often.
Right. I mean, this is like something that I've heard through the grapevine. Just don't ever pay a doctor's bill because it'll just keep coming down. Like
never pay the first bill is what we tell people.
Yeah.
When you go to, I mean, we always tell our folks mm-hmm. like if the collections agency is getting involved, you have mm-hmm. the hospital exactly where you want them. Mm-hmm. Like they have to now negotiate. Mm. And so a lot of people are like, oh my gosh, like how, you know, that's mm-hmm. annoying that you have to let it go to collections. But it's like, mm-hmm. look, you know, let's press the hard button sometimes, mm-hmm. you know, and have a low time preference on this. Mm-hmm. And if we can, you know, allow it to go to collections, the hospital has already said by mm-hmm. allowing it to go to collections, I know I'm not going to get paid, mm-hmm. you know, for everything that I build. Mm-hmm. And now that you can negotiate. So for Crowd Health, we provide actually attorneys mm-hmm. who will negotiate on your behalf. So you don't have to deal with it. Mm-hmm. So our attorney will send a note to the hospital basically saying, this is unfair. This mm-hmm. is price gouging. Mm-hmm. This is, you know, illegitimate trade practices. Here's a fair price. You know, you mm-hmm. can take it or, you know, let's go and pursue this in the courts. Mm-hmm. And so 99 times out of 100, the hospitals are like, okay, we'll take that. That mm. seems fair. And it's not like we don't want, you know, hospitals to not make money. Like mm. I want hospitals to make money. They're a for-profit organization. But mm. when you're billing $5,400 for something that the marginal cost is $3, mm. something else is going on.
Right.
Like that, you are horrifically run if you can't make those margins work. For anybody who understands business, that's a 99.9%, you know, gross margin. If you can't make that business model work, something is for sure wrong.
But nothing mm. about healthcare is incentivized towards efficiency.
No.
Mm. Nothing.
Mm. Well, tell me more about that. What's so inefficient about the current healthcare system? Besides the economic aspect, I'm guessing you're by qualifying it by saying like nothing. There's other aspects.
I mean, I've worked in a hospital system, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, there's just a huge layer of bureaucracy, right? Mm-hmm. Meetings, everything is you know, nothing's proactive. Mm. It's all reactionary. Mm. Just the type of people that are attracted, I think, mm. to bureaucracy, just like any other bureaucracy, they're not creative thinkers. Mm-hmm. I mean, for instance, nurses don't get nurses aren't paid based on, if, like, the only way that you can get raises through the ascension system as an RN is this, I even forget what they call it now, but basically, you know, doing projects and checking, there's no performance-based rewards there. So nobody's incentivized to, you know, work harder or make sure that outcomes are better. I mean, now there are some incentives with insurance companies, you know, like if a patient gets readmitted within a certain period of having been discharged, then the insurance companies won't pay. But just the incentives, I mean, you know, are not there, just like the health insurance companies are not incentivized. You know, they won't pay for health optimization or a lot of preventative care. They only, it's reactionary.
Yeah, I mean, I think it kind of comes down to, like, the people who are paying for the healthcare are not the people who are receiving the healthcare.
Skin in the game, yeah.
Right,
yeah.
And so I think Saylor says something like, if you're not paying for the product, you are the product, right? And so in essence, you know, I'll give you another example of this ER visit. They said, hey, you've got a migraine. 30 minutes later, an OT, occupational therapist and physical therapist walk in. They're like, hey, we just have to do a little bit of an assessment on you so we can get you out of here. You know, they watched me brush my teeth, put on my socks and walk down the hall. And they charged me 6 15-minute visits to do that. Like, even though they were there for 10 minutes, right? Now, me, if I were the consumer, which in crowd health I am, I'm going to push back. And I said, you were not there for 90 minutes, right? Like, and all you did was watch me brush my teeth. I'm not paying you $2,200 for that, right? The insurance company would just be like, okay, great. Let's go. Like, there's no way for them to know what's going on there. But now I'm the one that it's empowered to say I did that or I did not do that, right? The other thing was they knew I had a migraine by 3 o'clock in the afternoon the day I went in. I did not get out of the hospital until noon the following day for a migraine because the neurologist just hadn't gotten to it yet. So if I were, you know, I'm paying, I'm saying, look, no, get me out of here as soon as you know that I don't have, you know, a significant condition because I'm paying for it. But when the hospital, when the an insurance plan pays for it, we don't care. Like, we just give me, you know, an echocardiogram and Instagram and a mammogram. Like, give me everything. Like, get whatever you
need. And on
the
other side of that, the neurologist isn't incentivized to be efficient, to see you as quickly as possible and get you out of there.
Because that's more profit for the hospital.
It's more profit for the hospital, and there's zero incentive to get me out. Now, if the hospital were to look at that and say, okay, I can get a neurologist in here and pay him to be there, or else I'm going to have to eat the next 24 hours of care because I didn't do that, they would probably be incentivized to get that neurologist in there, but they're not. So there's like, okay, we're just going to let you sit there for, you know, 18 hours or whatever it was. And since, even though we were the ones that didn't get you the neurologist, you're going to pay for that 18 hours. Like, that's an inefficient system. I am not ultimately the buyer in an insurance system. The insurance company is, and therefore there's nobody on the ground watching what I'm getting or not
getting.
But with crowd health, it was kind of fun because I was sitting in the bed. I was like, I'm going to watch what's happening here, right? And I'm going to be able to go back and be like, you gave me 250 milliliters of saline or 500 milliliters or whatever it was, right? Which for $5,400, like, that's not right. You can't do that. So,
and luckily you were in the position to be able to watch. You know, some people, when they're in this type of situation in a hospital, aren't cognizant, you know, they're in a physical state where they can't do that. Which brings up a point, like, how important it is to have an advocate, someone, you know, if you weren't capable of doing that, a wife or somebody else there with you. And there's so many reasons for that.
Totally. So the way that we work, Jimmy, is, you know, I get those bills from the hospital. Somebody at Crowd Health will walk through that bill and is like, hey, this is, you know, a 250 milliliter bag of salt water. You know, did you actually get that for the entire time, or did they come and go? Okay, great. This is occupational therapy. Did they give you any kind of therapy? Because they billed you for three therapy visits. And I was like, no, they didn't give me therapy. So we'll walk you through that and be like, okay, this is no good. This is no good. This is no good. Oh, by the way, you also got an MRI bill here and an MRI bill here. Did you have two MRIs or one MRI? I had one MRI. Okay, great. Let's take care of that. So we do all that on the back end. We then give it to the attorney. The attorney will then reach out to the hospital and say, overcharged, charged us for stuff that you didn't do, you know, price gouging, you know, here's what the fair price is. And they'll even either say yes or no. The vast majority of the time they'll say yes because they don't want to fight that. Mm-hmm. But that's us providing market forces for those services to drive that cost down to something that's reasonable and fair. Again, I'm not trying to put hospitals out of business, even though they are massively inefficient structures. But we shouldn't be paying, you know, $5,400 for a bag of salt water.
Costs a dollar. So, I mean, it's plastic and salt water, literally.
Right. Well, so this brings up, I think, for me, the bigger issue, which is that, in a sense, like these hospitals, a lot of the healthcare industrial complex has taken your trust and abused it, right? They're lying and saying they visited you six times when they visited you once or twice.
Yeah.
And they're saying, and they're like, it's hard to know how much of it is incompetence versus like just malice.
I think it's mostly incompetence, or greed.
I mean, nothing that you need to trust more than your healthcare provider, especially with like a life-threatening injury. Yet these systems seem very untrustworthy. Like how do we, I guess, navigate something that's so untrustworthy? I guess is my question, given like demonstrated.
As Andy said, I don't think you can, but I think it's really wrapping your head around the fact that's the case, because people think that when they have health insurance that they are covered. Because the number one question I get, well, Crowd Health, well, what if I have to go to the hospital? How do I know they'll cover me? You know, because and they're operating under the assumption that if they had traditional health insurance, they'd be covered 100%. But as we've discussed, that's clearly not the case.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's number one is you got to find practitioners who are aligned, you know, and that's why we're making this kind of really big push into Bitcoin, where I believe that Bitcoin practitioners like Veronica, just they operate differently. They seek truth. They are looking for an alternative, and you know, they're not a pharma first. They are a, you know, nutrition, lifestyle, exercise first. Pharma, you know, well down the path if that doesn't work. And so I think you've got to get people on your side, on your team, who are actually your allies, you know. And I think, you know, Veronica's practice is a great thing. Is like, hey, she's an ally to her members. So, you know, if I was a member of
Ultra Personal,
if I was sitting there in the hospital bed, I could call Veronica and be like, here I am, here's what's going on. Please, you know,
or text me, hey, what do you think about that? They want to do this, this, and this. What do you agree with that? I mean, I've had patients do that, you know.
So align yourself with these practitioners who are your allies, truly on your side. That's why I like a direct primary care, concierge type of medicine, like Ultra Personal. You know, for Crowd Health, one of the things I hated was when I had to call into an insurance company and I had to, you know, talk to a call center in India or something. And they couldn't understand me and they punted me to all, you know, all over the world, you know, in call centers. And so we've got people internally who are your advocates. They, you know, you have your personal advocate. You're going to talk to the same person every time or vast majority of the time. They get to know you. They get to know who you are. They get to know your family. They are your ally, not your enemy. Right. Your insurance company is an enemy, even though they're supposed to be your agent. They're your enemy because, you know, it's everybody like, now I got to fight with my health insurance company. Right. So get people on your team who are your advocates and your allies. And I think that's the number one way of doing this. If you're relying upon health insurance to pay, you're relying upon them to pay. Like, they may pay, they may not pay. It's up to them. That's what you have bought into, you know, and that's where, for me, it's like, I'm not buying into that anymore. You know, I'm going to be empowered to figure out how to pay and not pay. And we got a community of thousands of people who will help in the case of my ER bill. But I think that's so important. Like, find people who can be your allies. Health insurance
and get
companies
the middleman,
are not.
No, so get them out of the picture. You know, people think that, you know, it's expensive, for instance, to have a concierge service, that they can't afford it. I think it's a lot more affordable than people understand, especially when you factor in these things. I mean, you can have a membership with Ultra Personal that covers all of your routine healthcare needs and catastrophic coverage with Crowd Health, and that's likely going to be less expensive for you than a traditional health insurance premium. And on top of that, you're going to get much better quality of care and better coverage.
Yeah. And an ally and lower deductible, you know, the no deductibles and things like that. Like it's a way better model that, you know, we've put together than with the current model out there in so many different ways.
So it sounds like what you guys are saying is, you know, instead of trusting these faceless bureaucracies and large corporations, actually find people that you trust and like have a relationship with these people. And
that's what healthcare originally was.
Yeah,
right.
It's relationship based care where me as a healthcare provider, I know you, I know your whole family. I may come to your home and know what your living situation is like. Mm-hmm. And then on top of that, you know, and we help navigate things. You've got someone like Andy in Crowd Health, who's another layer to that. All people working to you for you who are incentivized, like I'm incentivized. I'm paid the same whether you're sick and in my office constantly or whether I see you once or twice a year. So I'm incentivized to keep you healthy and out of my office.
Incentives rule. I mean, we know that being Bitcoiners. Like, what is the incentive of the organization in which you are for sending money to? You know, and health insurance incentives, we just talked about it, are not aligned with you. You know, we're Crowd Health, it's like we're $50 a month in subscription fees, whether you're healthy or you're sick. And guess what? If you're healthy, you're probably going to be a Crowd Health member longer than if you're sick. So what is our incentive to keep you healthy, to make you, you know, one of our goals is like, when I say this over and over again, is like, I want you to be 80 running around the backyard with your grandkids. Like that is success, you know, for us. Whereas, you know, a lot of these insurance plans, they make more money when you are sick. You know, and here's the other thing too, is if healthcare wasn't so expensive, you wouldn't need health insurance. Like health insurance actually has an incentive to keep healthcare really expensive or you wouldn't need them. Right. I mean, that's the craziness. That's the highest level of perverse incentives. And so that's why we're just like ditch health insurance and try something else.
Well, so I think the case for sort of not dealing with the health insurance bureaucracy, I think you guys have made. Let's talk about another sort of like giant gorilla or 800-pound gorilla in healthcare, which is pharma, right? Like drug companies. Tell my audience about like the incentives of the drug companies and how they work and like what doctors and healthcare providers, what like how are they incentivized with respect to drugs and how do they get assigned? What like, because in a sense, I think a lot of people are, especially after 3 years of COVID, a little more skeptical about the role these companies play.
Sure.
And like, what how does it work right now? And what causes a healthcare provider to say, I'm prescribing you this? And is that like, can you trust that? Or like, what's the deal here?
I don't think it's as direct as a lot of people might think. But it starts in medical school. It starts in the education. It's an indoctrination system. I mean, pharma is a huge contributor to a lot of the major medical schools, medical societies. So they're kind of, I mean, as providers are indoctrinated into the sick care model where, you know, we prescribe prescriptions to manage disease, right? And I think, you know, they get maybe 8 hours in medical school on nutrition. You know, I can't remember what I got in, you know, my nursing through nursing programs, but it's something on par with that. I mean, it's, and then there's no education about exercise and light and relationships and emotional health, right? So, I mean, it starts with that, the educational, you know, they're indoctrinated into just that pharmaceutical model, sick care model through the education system. Because it's not like, oh, if I write a prescription for Rybelsus, which is a diabetes med, I'm not getting a kickback on that. I think in the past that might have been the case, or at least, you know, doctors, you know, oh, well, you can be a special speaker for our dinner series and we'll fly you to, you know, they were getting a Cancun for this, you know, thing. But it wasn't like, oh, here's a, you know, $10 for each prescription, right? But that's, I think that's a major part of it. as far as, you know, the incentives for prescribing medications for the pharmaceutical companies?
I think it's as pharmaceutical companies have been used primarily as symptom erasers as opposed to like core issue evaluators, right? So it's one of those things where if you only have, I don't know what it is with primary care under the insurance system, but it's like 7 or 8 minutes or something like that, the average doctor has with you. He sees symptoms. He has a pharma solution. I'm going to give you a pharma solution to solve your symptoms.
It's like, this one size fits all algorithm based medicine.
And you know, and what they ultimately should be doing is they should be saying, okay, well, let's talk about your lifestyle. Let's talk about what you're eating. Let's talk about your exercise. Let's talk about all these other things to figure out, can we erase these symptoms and get your kind of core human being better as opposed to just erasing symptoms. So they don't get to the core issue. And so it's a very easy, quick way of erasing symptoms and that patient is happy because they don't no longer have their symptoms. You know,
but if you're indoctrinated, like the more medications you use, I mean, you're going to be prescribed because you're not going to get well.
Right.
You're just going to be managed.
Yeah.
And so you are a consumer of the pharmaceutical company forevermore.
And I think it's kind of goes back to this low time preference thing, right? Like we have a high time preference in our society where I want to get better now. And even though I have to shoot up a bunch of pharma, whereas a lot of times these sicknesses, especially with your common everyday sicknesses, are your body's way of responding to a virus or a bacteria or whatever it is. And they are, it's responding. It's your body doing what it's supposed to be doing to get rid of this thing. And so what we're doing now is we're saying, okay, we're going to take a bunch of meds so that we can feel better now, as opposed to letting your body do it over the next week or something like that. Right?
Yeah, really, it's it's indoctrination on multiple angles. Because that's the thing. Symptoms are, I tell my patients, symptoms are messengers from the body. Right? It's the body, you know, telling us, you know, what's, hey, you know, something's off here. You know, it's a smoke signal. You need to go do some investigating. And what do? We medicate that away now. And so, you know, that's a big part of the problem.
You know, the actual structure of this is somewhat complex, but it's, you have these health insurance companies, and then you have what they call PBMs or pharmacy benefit managers in the middle. And then, and those pharmacy benefit managers are tied into all the pharmacies so that when you, the member, shows up to the pharmacy, you swipe your card and the pharmacy benefit manager knows what your copay is and is the medicine on your, the formulary of the insurance company, and they own the middle. But as a result of that, they also take a big, you know, chunk. So I actually just put
more of the bureaucracy.
So I just put something up on Twitter today, actually, which was a Joe Rogan interview where the guy, this guy who owns a pharmacy said, look, an old white lady comes in and wants metformin. You know, that cost me $2. I would charge her $4 if she would pay in cash. But once she tells me she has insurance, this guy said he was in a gag order so that he can't actually tell the woman that she, he could sell it to her for $4. But now the, you know, she swipes the card and your copay is $10. Right.
Yeah. No, I mean,
and then the rest goes to the PBM. The PBM is taking the rest. So she could have paid $4.
It's crazy.
Instead, she's paying $10, and the difference in that, the delta, goes to the pharmacy benefit manager. And so, like, that's a
that's a definition of a rent seeker. That's literally rent seeker.
That is
rent seeker. And that's not just the the prescriptions, right? The same thing happens with your doctors. If your doctor knows, for instance, that you have United Health Insurance, they cannot charge you their cash pay rate. If they're contracted with United Health Insurance.
Wow. And it can be exactly like this, where it would be $50, but
it's
now your copay is $100.
Exactly. It's the exact same thing.
I mean, people think that, you know, United Healthcare, you kind of have these economics 101, right? United Healthcare is huge. They must have tons of power. And so they're going to get the best price. But in fact, you as an individual have way more negotiating power than United Healthcare does. And so we as individuals can pay way less than United Healthcare. And that's why we say pay direct, pay in cash, pay in Bitcoin before you'll ever pay in health insurance, because you will get vastly better prices. People look at CrowdHealth, they're like, this is impossible that you're charging me half of what, or oftentimes a third of what United Healthcare was paying. That's impossible. I'm like, okay, well, you know, if you just show up paying in, you know, cash or Bitcoin, you're going to get 50% better prices than United Healthcare. I mean, that's pretty much all the difference right there. Uh-huh. And then add to it, you have a bunch of people in their 30s and their 40s mm-hmm. who are taking care of themselves and, you know, are metabolically healthy. Like, add that to it, and it kind of magnifies the impact of that, right? Mm-hmm. So that's how the economics of crowd health works, is paying in cash with a bunch of people who, you know, are mm-hmm. taking care of themselves. It's a pretty powerful impact to healthcare costs.
And they're taking care of themselves because they have skin in the game.
Because they have skin in the game.
And there's motivation on all the advocates on your side to make sure that you're healthy.
They now have agency over their own health. Whereas I am, you know, outsourcing agency to a health insurance company, ultimately, if I have health insurance. Mm. And that does, we've seen it over and over and over again, have behavioral change. Mm. So, yeah, I mean, I think pharma is a scam. One of the things that we've you know, already talked about is they're huge lobbyists too. Mm-hmm. So lots of legislation goes their way, including getting a vaccine out in, you know, months to people who, you know, are being told by the government to take it without even questioning.
Being told not to take ivermectin and for some reason. Yeah.
And they have immunity for, they're not, talk about incentives, they're not incentivized to safety.
Yeah. Well, so I want to touch on that a little bit, because you mentioned earlier that, you know, if you do prescribe or if you do symptom management, essentially they stay sick.
Yeah.
So in a sense, the incentives of the doctors are such that if they stay sick, well, you have more customers. They're
going to keep coming back.
It's like recurring revenue.
Yeah, yeah. For like chronic diseases, correct, like diabetes or something like that, you just keep coming back instead of actually getting cured, and you're kind of a customer for life. Like, you know, from my world, like, you know, like app development or like websites or whatever. Yeah. Like you think in terms of lifetime customer value.
Yeah. LTV.
Significantly higher if you have somebody with a chronic condition versus somebody that, like, That seems to be a pretty terrible incentive. And the drugs kind of make that happen.
Is that it plays a part, right? Because take something like eczema, for instance. A kid with eczema, you know, you go to a regular doctor that spends 5 or 10 minutes with you, you're going to get a prescription for maybe topical steroids. If it's really bad, oral steroids, right? Mm-hmm. Which, what does that do? It just dampens, because what is eczema? It's an overactive immune response.
Yes.
So the steroids dampens the immune system, okay? And so you're just dampening that immune response, but you're not getting to the core cause. Whereas, you know, for me, one of the things why is the immune system reacting in that way in the first place? And investigating and addressing that, which is really not that difficult to do. And then the child doesn't have eczema anymore.
Right.
But like, these are a lot of these conditions, I mean, diabetes, I mean, all of this stuff, for the most part, it's curable. Mm. It's reversible. It's curable. Mm. But not if you're just managing the disease with medications.
90% of type 2 diabetes is curable. Mm. And we spend $1 trillion a year on diabetics. $1 trillion.
I mean,
so, you know, type 2 diabetes, I mean, you can correct me if I'm wrong here, but it's like, it is a lifestyle disease where over a long period of time, you've chosen a lifestyle that ultimately has, you know, your insulin response or whatever resistance. And so you can reverse that by just, you know, lifestyle changes over a period of time. You can reverse that. And so that's $1 trillion. I mean, 90% of diabetics are type 2. So it's 90% are type. Yeah, or lifestyle related. Type 1 is when you're born with it. Typically, something goes awry, so it's not a lifestyle issue. But like $1 trillion can be erased. Almost $1 trillion can be erased if people would just eat better and work out.
But it's the mindset around that too. Have you been to a hospital and see what they serve diabetics on a tray? it's
apple pie or something.
Yes, and they're like, oh well, we'll just dial up the insulin for that. I mean, it's a crazy way to think about that.
Yeah.
Whereas, oh, maybe we could just take the carbs off the tray, and we don't have to give insulin to begin with.
Well, so let's talk about that too, because that's another part of the equation that you guys have been repeatedly coming back to, which is sort of like lifestyle stuff. How much does food have to do with this health stuff? I've had other people on the show to talk about food, and you know, a significant amount of the healthcare sort of debacle that we're in, like they've told me is due to food, like just the nutrition has been taken out. It's
hyper-palatable.
Yeah, hyper-palatable, hyper-sugary, hyper...
Seed like, oils.
Yeah, just all kinds of stuff that's just bad for you. How much of the healthcare system is having to compensate for the debasement of the food?
It's a large percentage, you know, and another big contributing factor, of course, is exercise. Mm. Light environment, which that's something that's really just coming up. There is, I think it was Nature Mental Health had a just the latest issue was about light and how that impacts mental health. Mm. It also impacts diabetes, which a lot of people are unaware of. Blue light, these lights that we're sitting in front of actually raise our cortisol and insulin levels. Mm. But then emotions and relationships and trauma, you know, all of those things are huge factors. But food, yeah, that's a major one. You know, and these pharmaceutical companies, right, and these big agro companies, I mean, it's, you know.
But yeah, that's a large part of it.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a huge, so it's you know, the fact that we're making decisions of what we're putting into our body, the secondary component of that was what is the makeup of that, you know, what we're putting into our body. I think both are going awry. So diabetes has gone from 1% in 1970 to almost 10%. Mm-hmm. Now, pre-diabetes is, I don't know what I it mean, was in 1970, but it's like 40% or 50% or something like that now. Obesity went from like 10%. Now it's overweight is like 70% of the American population. Americans, there's an organization with 32 countries that all share information. It's all continents, or, you know, six of the seven continents. And they share all this information. And the United States is twice as obese per capita as the average of these other 32 countries. And so, you know, obesity plays a massive role in this. You know, the funny thing to me is people look at the United States healthcare outcomes and they say, oh, well, look, United States, you're spending all this money and your outcomes are worse. And I was like, well, outcomes are going to be worse if you're 400 pounds versus if you're 180 pounds, right? Maternal mortality is going to be much worse if you are overweight. Infant mortality is going to be much more overweight. But guess what? If you have a, you know, a type of cancer or heart issues or whatever, like the Saudi royal family flies to United States to get these procedures done because we have the best doctors on the planet here in this country. It's just we've got a population of people who are way obese, and you are going to get worse outcomes when you, you know, have 30, 40, 50%, you know, fat indexes. And so you're going to get worse outcomes.
Yeah, and technology, it's great, and you know, when you need it for things like breast cancer and different surgeries, right? There is a place for that, but technology isn't going to solve the problem that causes diabetes and obesity and these drivers of chronic inflammatory illnesses.
And a large part of that is food. Some of it is like lack of exercise, sunlight, possibly, and stuff like that.
Well, and then we consume seed oils. We consume all these chemicals that oftentimes are
toxins,
illegal in the vast majority of the world, but in the United States, it's fine. We consume all this, you know, glyphosate, which is being spread out over our, you know, food, and we're basically consuming, Roundup weed killer is ultimately
right because they've genetically modified the food, right? Because they used to just spray it like around on the weeds, but now they genetically modified the wheat, etc., so they can just spray the full fields, wheat and everything included, and it won't harm the wheat, right?
Right. Yeah, I mean, and so all these, a lot of these cancers have been like 0% of the population and have grown exponentially over the last 50 years. I mean, there's that website that's like WTF 1972 or whatever it
71,
is. 71. You know, all this stuff went awry. Depegging of gold, the HMO Act of 1972, I think, which is kind of codified our insurance system. You know, the food pyramid was started in the 1970s. It didn't actually come to be a government, you know, mandated thing until the 1990s, but that's when it started. It was in the 1970s. These conversations were happening around let's use corn as one of the primary drivers of our food system. And so all this stuff happened at the exact same time. So in the 19 1970s to the 2020s, that 50 years destroyed our monetary system, our health system, and our food system. Mm. Amazing to me that we can destroy that much in, you know, one generation, basically.
Yeah, I guess there's quite a lot that's been destroyed to sort of like put our health in this sort of weird situation. All right, so I guess the practical aspect of it, what would you recommend people do, or how would you, like, if you could have people just sort of like learn something about the system so that they can at least like have better outcomes, I guess. What would you suggest? I mean, besides your own services, right? Obviously, that's something that
I thought you were going to throw a softball up for us there. No.
Besides that, I think people know that. But like, besides that, what other things would you recommend people do so that they don't end up with these disastrous outcomes? What like, how do you think people should think about their health?
I guess. I think it comes down to taking radical personal responsibility. Because the dirty truth is that your doctor doesn't know how to keep you healthy.
Mm. Wow. That's something.
They only know how to treat disease.
Even you, Veronica. If I went to you.
So there's a small percentage of us who do know how to keep you healthy, but you can't depend bet on that.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing that I really kind of learned over the last few years, kind of being like down the rabbit hole of this, is I think everybody needs to understand where's their metabolic health.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are kind of five components of metabolic health. It's, you know, your waistline, your blood pressure, your triglycerides, your HDL, and your A1C.
Mm-hmm.
You can get all of those things figured out for under $50. Mm-hmm. Like, that is a $50 investment in knowing where your body currently sits.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, talk to your doctor, probably, you know, a practitioner like Veronica or somebody who's on the same page. It's like, okay, here are of the five, I'm missing one or two of these. How can I improve these? And just really focus in on like those five metabolic components. And that will reduce your probability of a chronic condition by about 80%. Mm-hmm. Like, if you are metabolically healthy, which 88% of us aren't, you will drop your probability of a chronic condition by 80%. So it's very tangible. I mean, they are tangible metrics that you can look at and say, okay, I need to reduce my waistline, right? I need to reduce my blood pressure. Okay, how do I do that? You know, those are the types of things that I would really focus on, and we're having our members focus on. It's like, you need to know those five things. It's not expensive. Do it twice a year. That's $100.
Mm. And I would add to that a vitamin D level too, because that's very much influences your metabolic health.
And we saw that during COVID, right? Like, it was the people,
they told you to stay inside, which is the worst thing you can do for your immune system.
And well, so let's talk about that sort of as like a final thing, because we didn't touch on this. What do you make of sort of like government pronouncements of all of this stuff that you should do? Because we've been given health advice for the last 3 years that pretty much we're all wrong.
Runs counter. It's not just the last 3 years.
Yeah, well, perhaps.
So that's the mistake, to think that it's just been the last 3 years that's happened.
Maybe that's when it's been exposed to people like me, but yeah.
So, but just take that, what happened the last 3 years, and then realize, oh my God, this is not just a blip. This is how it works.
Mm.
I mean, talk about saturated fat, cholesterol. You know, the American Heart Association just quietly removed about 5 years ago, the ceiling on saturated fat restrictions. They didn't make any major announcement about that because that has no impact on, mortality.
Mm.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, I think, again, I'm pretty skeptical on this. The food pyramid was kind of delivered to the US public in the 1980s, mid 1990s, in that 10-year period, to different degrees, and ultimately in the bottom of the food pyramid is grains. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's like
eating
pasta and, you know, all kinds of good stuff that actually is pretty delicious, but like really bad for you.
Hyper palatable.
hyper palatable.
And empty of nutrients.
Mm. Empty of nutrients. It was developed during a time of hyperinflation in which, you know, you could really get that type of food for a really low cost. We need to drive down inflation. We're going to send a bunch of subsidies to the farmers who are built, you know, doing corn. Now we're throwing a bunch of it away, you know, every year, even though we're paying for it. And so, you know, it's there are definitely incentives behind closed doors that we don't fully understand that are driving a lot of these policy decisions that are not in our best interest. Mm. You know, that food pyramid is not in our best interest. I mean, the top of the food pyramid, which means the smallest amount of stuff that you should have is animal proteins. Or no, I guess it was on the second level and then like sugar or whatever.
But don't you know those are carcinogenic? Yeah.
Well, and now we have this, you know, thing going on where, you know, cows are bad for the environment because
global
warming. And so there's always, I feel like, a component of control here that is driving some of these policy decisions. And even, you know, back in the COVID days of, you know, Fauci saying like, you cannot transmit COVID if you have this vaccine, you know, with a definitive, you know, statement, you know, I would have just appreciated like, hey, at this point, given the data, we don't think you can transmit, but but to come out and definitively say it does not transmit is just lying to the public based on no real scientific information. I mean, what happened to the scientific process that I think we all learned in like third grade, right? Which is this literally a process. You come up with a hypothesis, you test it, and you retest it, and then you come up. Like, that's just not being done nowadays. Mm-hmm. We're going directly from hypothesis to conclusion without any of the in between. And I think that conclusion is based upon some kind of cognitive bias that allows us to control, have power, all human nature type of stuff rooted in pride, probably. And that's, you know, again, I don't mean to become too negative on, you know, government intervention, although I think a lot of it is driven by those.
Those emotions. On government intervention.
Please be. Yeah.
I mean, I'd almost say you know, just run counter to whatever the government says is healthy and safe for
me. Do the exact opposite.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. It's that bad an indicator.
To me it is, yeah.
Wow.
I mean, there's a reason I'm you know, bought land and am on land and outside and you know, raising my own sheep and chickens and eggs. Mm-hmm.
And I guess you're probably drinking raw milk and things like that.
How'd you know?
Just a guess. But that is interesting that you two have obviously a lot of experience in the healthcare system, and you don't trust the bureaucrats. That's interesting.
Shocking.
Yeah. Because in a sense, that's what we're all told to like trust is trust the experts, the bureaucrats that have been in charge for a while.
Do you trust the bureaucrats when it comes to the monetary system?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not.
I do think it comes down to, though, a lot of this is it is a high time preference versus a low time preference approach, which is, you know, let's press the easy button right now so that we can satisfy whatever's going on in our immediate future without thinking about how is what we're doing now going to not just impact us today, but is going to impact us for years and years and years, right? Like that vaccine, yes, it may have saved lives. I don't know. I mean, my dad was in the nursing home at the time. I may have saved lives within that nursing home. I don't know. But what was the impact on the 20-year-olds and the 30-year-olds for the next 20 years? Like, let's think about that before we make a pronouncement that everybody has to get, you know, vaccinated. And it's the same thing going on in the monetary system where let's just pour money into the economy now to solve what is now, yet we're having rampant inflation that's probably downplayed by this stupid CPI index, right, that we know is higher than what they're reporting. And there's a long-term consequence to this. And so in essence, I think if we got back to this culture, which I think our ancestors had, which is like, let's make investments now that may not pay off for 10, 20, 30 years, which is the best thing we can do for our health. Like, let's make investments now in our 40s so that when we're in our 70s and 80s, we can play with our kids in the backyard and our grandkids in the backyard. this high time preference culture is destroying our monetary system, it's destroying our healthcare system, it's destroying our food system. And if we all could just say, like, hey, let's go back to low time preference, let's make an investment in our health, in our money, in our food, I think that would solve so many problems. But so we like hitting the easy button, you know, and that's what we're trying to get people at Crowd Health not to do. Like, yes, it's easy to throw down your insurance card, but guess what? You're going to get an explanation of benefits in the mail in a few weeks, right?
Yeah.
And so it solves your issue now, but you got to deal with it later.
And understanding that you can't outsource these things.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. You've got to take radical personal responsibility for that. And that's come down to, you know, that comes down to your health. That comes down to your food. I've learned over the past year that comes down to educating my children.
Mm.
You know, any responsibility that I lay down and don't take up can be used against me by a tyrant, you know, and I've seen that happen over and over again over the last few years, you know, and it's difficult, you know, sovereignty requires taking a lot of responsibility, and can be a difficult pill to swallow. Mm. But if you're willing to do that, you can have a really amazing life.
In Bitcoin, we say not your keys, not your coins. Mm, yeah. I think what you're saying is if it's not my health, then you know, if it's not my responsibility, then it's not really your health.
Right. Like if I'm sending my child to a school that I don't know what they're teaching them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The only way for me to know what's going on there is for me to be directly involved with it.
Yeah, I'll have to do another episode on education at some point.
Yeah, but that'd be a good one.
It's healthcare is, I think, as you guys have said, pretty messed up. And so I know I keep saying final question, but really, real final question: how does this system collapse, and what do you think happens afterwards?
Yeah, I mean, I think unfortunately, what is going to happen is you see government encroachment in kind of all facets of healthcare right now. You know, first it was, you know, Medicare, you know, which is old, Medicaid, which is poor. And now they've done healthcare.gov, which is kind of that next percentage, you know, say 20% of the population above poor. They're saying I'm subsidizing you fully through healthcare.gov plans, though it's through private insurance. The remaining chunk is commercial carriers, so it's your companies who are paying for this. I think companies are going to go to the government and saying this is putting us at a disadvantage versus China or wherever, because I've got to pay the health insurance as opposed to the United States government paying for it, and therefore you need to take that off of our plate. You need to assume that responsibility of taking care of our healthcare, so I don't have to. And so, in essence, what's going to be transitioned to a single payer system is where I see it going over the next 10 to 20 years, unless something drastic happens. So I think we're just inevitably headed that way.
Towards single payer. Wow.
Towards single payer. And I think if it hasn't been super clear, like, that's clearly not the way I want it to go.
Right.
Single payer then, in essence, puts pressure on our monetary system because expenses will go out of control. We'll have to print more money, which will then create inflation, which will then create higher interest rates. And so we're going to live in this high inflation, high interest rate environment for an extended period of time. And that, unless Bitcoin or somebody like Crowd Health or everybody joins DPC or, you know, there's some kind of structural change that happens, we are, in essence, supporting a single payer system because it's putting so much pressure on corporations. I think that's ultimately what's going to happen.
Your thoughts?
I agree. Yeah. I mean, just monetarily, we're not going to be able to support that.
It's just too much bureaucracy that they have to make an even bigger bureaucracy to cover up the previous bureaucracy.
It's kind of the same thing with a central bank digital currency, right?
I suppose, yeah.
Well, I mean, I think it's a similar, you know, path of what we're talking about in terms of fiat right now, right? Like, it's just too easy to keep pressing this easy button that there's no way to turn that around. I mean, there's no way that we're going to be able to turn around our budget to be, you know, cash flow positive. And so you're going to have to continue to print money. That's going to put pressure on the dollar. Every single currency in the history of man has failed. The dollar will do it. Safedine was on my podcast. He gave me a 15-year over-under on that. And so, you know, it's like, what can you do in terms of monetary? It's like you got to put a significant portion of your assets in Bitcoin. That's mm-hmm. what I'm doing. It's not financial advice, just mm-hmm. what I'm doing. You know, in healthcare, mm-hmm. you've got to be sovereign over your own health and do something. If it's not crowd health, do find something else, but mm-hmm. like be sovereign over your own healthcare and get out of that system. And for food, it's, you know, like, look, you got to stop inhaling, you know, carbohydrates and take the food pyramid, invert it. And that's pretty much, it's way closer
local,
to what it should be.
Local mm-hmm. seasonal food.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Local seasonal. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I love that. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Well, so, so the system's going to collapse. It's going to yes. be single payer.
Yeah, people are getting sicker and sicker. I mean, I think over the last couple of years, our life expectancy has actually gone down.
Yeah, gone the obstruction.
Yeah. Wow. Oh, that's a happy note.
Happy ending.
I do think that you know, it gets worse before it gets better. I think clearly that's sort of like the pattern of these things. But that is quite sobering, and hopefully the people that are watching this podcast or listening to this podcast can kind of at least prepare for it. Maybe having extra savings, making way relationships.
The positive spin on that too, mm-hmm. to leave you on a positive note, is that you know these things are reversible.
Mm. Mm. Like your body.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So. What the great things about Bitcoin is it gives me hope that there is an alternative here that mm-hmm. will actually work.
Mm.
If I didn't, you know, have hope that crowd health could change the way that we pay for healthcare, I wouldn't show up every day.
Mm.
And so I think there are things out there that give me hope that we can mm-hmm. change direction. You know, we just need people out there to not, you know, keep pressing the easy button mm-hmm. and, you know, diving into Bitcoin and what it's about and trying to understand it, diving into an alternative way to pay for healthcare, diving into another way of getting care outside of the insurance system. Like we need, there's one thing I would say to your mm-hmm. listeners right now, it's like, you've got to make some investment of time in trying to understand this stuff. Cause if you continue to press the easy button, you are perpetuating the mm-hmm. demise of our healthcare system, our monetary system. These things are all very, very much connected. 20% mm-hmm. of our GDP goes to healthcare. Like that's a big chunk, right? Mm-hmm. So take a look and do some evaluation and make, you know, press the hard button in some cases, because I think it's worthwhile over the long term to take a different look at how you pay for your healthcare. Or how you mm-hmm. what you consider money, you know, mm-hmm. true money.
Right. I would say that more than that, I think there are economic incentives at play. And I think you got, at least in my experience with crowd health and like going to functional medicine doctors and things like that, it's significantly cheaper. I think people will figure it out just by economic incentives alone. Hey, this is cheaper. Why am I paying money into this black hole? Because people tell me to. And the people that avoid bankruptcy will be the ones that actually go through this process of figuring out, okay, this I'm paying for a bunch of bureaucrats that don't add anything to my life. What am I doing? And you know, in the end, I think perhaps that is the alternative to a single payer, that people do figure this stuff out and recognize that there's a different way of doing things. I mean, this what got a lot of people on to keto carnivore diets and stuff like that.
And that different way already exists.
Yeah.
It's not like we're having to create something in the future. It already exists.
And there's testimonies from people that have gone down this route and they have much better outcomes. So I'm hoping for this better path rather than a single payer. So anyway, with that, let's, well, thank you guys for coming.
Thanks, Jimmy.
Yeah, thank you.
Fun to be with you.
Unchained Capital is a sponsor of this podcast. I'm an advisor to the company. I know the team well, and I'm excited for what they are building. If you need multi-sig, collaborative custody, or a Bitcoin-native financial services partner, learn more at unchained.com.